So a wrap of the top business stories, and tonight we head out to the continent, joined on the line by Khanya Nzululeka, co-founder out at Satana Capital. Khanya, good evening to you. Welcome.
Evening, Aya. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm also very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. I hope you've had a good Human Rights Day or Shavulanga Day. Definitely, definitely. And I think it's not a bad thing to take the moment to rest. I guess as long as we take stock of... you know, what sacrifices have allowed for this day as a day of pause, as a moment of reflection for all of us in the society. And we'll certainly be covering a lot of that tonight on our show. But today, of course, markets closed for that public holiday. But business continues, and we shine a spotlight tonight on business out in the continent. I was saying to Andile earlier on, that I heard for the first time today about INSWA. And he says to me, no, ikhona mzimkhulu, but it has a different name. What did you make of this this delicacy, which it seems is in short supply out in Zambia at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I must admit it is my first time hearing about it as well.
Oh, now is Angwa
Yija Land. I mean, I've been to Zambia.
Sure.
I'll be honest, that if someone had actually offered it to me as a delicacy, I might have been a bit like, I don't know. But I mean, I think it's one of those things that, you know, if you read the story, is quite important to the local market. Mm. And, you know, it's something that, you know, for me, that really touched me. It appears to be a really good source of income for women in particular. And so I was, you know, it was quite heartbreaking to then read that they are now at a point where, you know, they can't actually catch enough for sale. They can only catch enough for home consumption. So, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you don't know who to look at, because, you know, it's about, you know, the destruction of anthills, according to the report, and also just the use of, you know, pesticides and the like. Mm. And it's really unfortunate, because it appears that they only appear at a certain particular time in the year. So, yeah, I'm really hoping that those women and, you know, men can find another way to actually bolster their income.
Interestingly, I mean, I guess there's probably something else which we might want to make sense of here. You know, somebody shared with us now on Twitter, Usiphulaphula Ngwevu, saying, you know, it's called izinhlwa in his language, which is not too far from inswa in, I assume this is Chichewa or I guess any of the other languages spoken out in Lusaka. The fact that we know this is a product largely sold by women in the informal sector, largely harvested and collected by women. There are big question marks about to what degree climate variability and change, and of course the intensifying use of pesticides and bringing more and more land under cultivation, to what degree, will that, I guess, limit the supplies of this product, and in so doing, I guess, limit the cuisine options in that part of the world?
Now, I think you touched on quite an important point to say, and I was actually, quite pleased that we get to actually touch on this particular point, because at the end of the day, who's actually taking into account the fact that, you know, these women actually need this, and are the people who actually, you know, in that country, who look after women and children, who look after, you know, things around, you know, economic development, are they considering this? There's also like a huge cultural and social aspect to it, to the preservation of culture, which is important. It's not necessarily something that should be treated as a very small point. And in places like, you know, Zambia and across Africa, we see it in South Africa here as well, the informal sector is very important, but often extremely neglected. And things like these aren't actually taken into account. So to your point, what is the role that things like pesticides and agricultural practices that don't actually, leave room for these insects to be able to come in their numbers? Is there someone who's going to be held accountable, or is it just going to be one of those things where, oh, okay, we're just going to move on? But, you know, it's very unfortunate, and we do hope that, you know, from a climate change perspective, it's a wake-up call to actually do something. And it's hopefully a wake-up call as well to, you know, the agriculture industry in Zambia.
Then, of course, there's the other question, which is, when you look at, I guess, this type of product, similar things are happening here in South Africa. I mean, we have Masonja. To what degree, I guess, have these delicacies and even indigenous knowledge systems on how it is to prepare them translated to any meaningful commercial and industrial advance? And should it? I don't know. But it just seems that, you know, it's somebody else who's going to come out from outside and then say, hey, I've realized you guys like this thing. Let me mass produce it. Rather than, I guess, many of us taking up that opportunity.
I mean, interestingly enough, I actually know someone who actually produces and packages a lot of indigenous foods, like things that I never even knew existed. And these are superfoods. These are foods that, abundant nature actually grew up on. Mm. And, you know, they are quite healthy. But, you know, with all the different, I don't want to call it fashion, but I think with all the knowledge that's now coming around diets and so forth, it's now becoming apparent that a lot of, you know, these products and a lot of these goods that we sort of said, oh, okay, that's archaic, we're not going to do that anymore. You know, people are looking into those and saying, okay, let's actually commercialize this and put it forward as like, you know, a health bar. You know, you have your matcha tea, you have your moringa tea and so forth. These are things that, you know, definitely, to your point, should be commercialized by those who actually have a great knowledge of how they are produced and how they actually can contribute to health. But it's often the case that, you know, without capital, you can't actually do much.
Sure.
And we see it as well with, you know, the cannabis industry. You know, there was so much excitement to say that a lot of the injustice that had previously been done in terms of people being criminalized for actually, you know, producing this plant that now all of a sudden is the wonder of the world. You know, how, first of all, what is the justice good that's going to be done for them? You know, in terms of like restoring them for the past injustices, but how are they actually going to be helped to participate? And there was all this hype, like, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And now we see that there are all these very stringent requirements. Like, you have to set up a lab. It's going to be about 5 million rand. It's a lot. And unfortunately, you know, that happens with everything that from in a capitalist society is discovered as having value. Certain people are pushed out. And I think it's important that this is something that people look into to say that this is important for our culture, for our country. We need to preserve it for, you know, posterity. And we also need to protect those who've been benefiting the most from this info.
Yeah, yeah. Let's stay out in SADC and head out to Mozambique. And also saw some news earlier on coming out of Maputo. You know, where Total was saying that the first liquefied natural gas exports only set to start out in 2027. And I assume the Frelimo government will be looking at that with, you know, very, very keen eyes, because on the one hand, they're a joint partner, but also for the tax revenue that might come from it. But let's shift our attention to something else, which I think has some relevance for us here at home. Mozambique submitted its first assessment report in its attempts to exit the grey list. Now, we know about grey listing here. They were placed on the grey list on October 21, 2022, a few months before we were. What do you make of this story? And I guess, some of the issues that got Mozambique here. I mean, one of them was some fraudulent sovereign loan. I don't know how else to explain it. And of course, we also do know that the former finance minister is still in jail here in South Africa, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, quite a number of African countries actually on that grey list. We have Tanzania, we have DRC, we now have South Africa, we have Mozambique. So, it's, you know, if you have a look at it, it's actually quite an interesting makeup. What a lot of people might not know is that we also have a blacklist, and that's where it's literally like we have to, you know, all the, you know, countries doing business with you need to save the ties. It's very harsh, you know, it's literally a blacklist. Whereas grey list is that, you know, the country has actually committed to work with the Financial Action Task Force and is under essentially increased monitoring. So, you know, like you said, Mozambique did enter this grey list exactly 5 months ago, I think, to this day. And, yeah, just submitting a plan around how they actually do plan to, you know, deal with some of the things that have been identified. And you've already mentioned some of them, but others pertain to anti-money laundering. And the big one is, you know, the country's policies around countering terrorist financing. And I think that's a big one for Mozambique. I mean, they've really been struggling in recent months with terrorist incidents. I mean, just a couple of days ago, there was a very unfortunate incident reported in the news. I think in the northern side of people being kidnapped and, you know, an attack where people were murdered. So I think that, you know, it's positive that the government is actually working, you know, with international partners to display that, you know, this is something that from their perspective as well, they take it seriously and they are, you know, moving forward. So, yeah, I think, you know, a number of suggestions made is that they need to analyze the role of non-financial institutions as well. And I think that also pertains and would also be something that South Africa needs to look into, because quite a lot of this activity, you know, you have a lot of regulation around banks and it's very strong. And to some extent, it is effective. Mm. However, you find that there are a lot of loopholes when it comes then to non-financial institutions, and you have a lot of flows that can actually begin to then move through that. So, yeah, I think that it's never great for a country to go through it, but it's great that, you know, the government is displaying a commitment to working through the plan, which is set to be for about 2 years.
Mm. You know, I guess the other question, of course, is, you know, in relation to... you know, when one looks at the grey listing, what are some of the remedial actions that are expected on the part of Zambia? And I want us to take a quick spot break, but when we come back, we'll return to that story and, of course, some of what Zambia has committed, Mozambique has committed to do, including the identification or strengthening the identification of beneficial ownership and some other international and national level actions in order to deal with this challenge of being grey listed. And we'll continue with Kanya on the other side of this. 17 minutes it is before 8 p.m. It's our wrap of the top business stories, and I'm speaking to Kanya Nzurulega tonight, co-founder out at Satana Capital, talking and getting some reflections on stories in the world of business out in our continent. Of course, markets closed today, it being a public holiday, and we certainly make sense of all of these big stories out in the continent. And yeah, if you just joined us, we're out in Mozambique, and Kanya, I guess the story there in relation to some of the actions that the Mozambicans need to take in order to be taken off of that grey list, it's about, you know, identification of beneficial ownership, and then, of course, a few other actions. And in the context, I guess, of the terrorist activities happening in parts of Mozambique, also strengthening anti-money laundering provisions.
So, yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that have been put forward. So, like I mentioned, it is over a two-year period where the FATF has given them the opportunity to display that they are going to rectify some of these deficiencies that have been identified. And one of those is, like you mentioned, being able to identify your beneficial owners. So we know that a lot of people who deal in illicit activities, they will actually hide, you know, their ownership of those funds through secret corporate structures, very fancy. And so, you know, the FATF has suggestions on how, you know, countries can go about identifying those and actually putting to a stop to that as soon as possible. But some of the other, you know, suggestions are essentially at a very broad level, developing a national and international plan to counter the money laundering. And that also involves, you know, conducting your training for your law enforcement agencies, you know, working with international partners and the like. And really just, you know, because I think what's so important is that it's going to be difficult for the FATF to police each transaction that happens, but countries need to display that at a very high level, there are policies, there are structures, and there are human resources that are actually deployed to fight, you know, the money laundering. So a lot of the suggestions are about building the capacity, ensuring that the adequate policies are put in place and are executed and operated on, and comprehensively developing a national risk assessment, you know, for government agencies as well as non-government organizations. So, yeah, I mean, it would be great to actually see that first assessment report to see how many of those points they've dealt with. It's about, you know, the last time I checked it was about, you know, 9. So, you know, some of the things that have been, you know, suggested to the Mozambican government. So it would be great to see, you know, the actual progress that they've made in the 5 months.
And then if we are to shift just briefly out to Uganda in East Africa, and a very interesting story here, and I did say earlier on, from an energy generation perspective, you know, their installed capacity much, much lower than what we have in this part of the world, and so too is the demand. So, you know, very low numbers of households in that part of the world who have access to the grid. But some ambitious plans. But one of the things they are putting paid to is a key feature of our own renewable energy process and independent power producer program, which is, you know, you pay for what has been generated under the power purchase agreement, whether or not you transmit it onto the grid. Now, that's part of our program. It has been part of, for the last 15 years, the Ugandan program. And Yoweri Museveni's people are saying no more.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's come out very strongly, and understandably so. Apparently, the government paid over $600 million for electricity that was produced but not used. And considering where the Ugandan economy is, that definitely isn't something that, you know, the government can afford. But I think that these take-or-pay models are... they are models that essentially were put in play many, many, you know, years ago, over a decade ago. And it's really to give investors that guarantee and that comfort that their investment will actually be recovered. And it makes it easier for your banks and so forth to actually put money towards a project, because you can look at it, but you don't have to look at it in much detail. You don't need to consider things like you said, okay, how many households do we actually have? You can consider it, but at the end of the day, your credit risk is facing the government. You're not necessarily considering then what's actually going to happen on the back. And that is actually a consideration that governments then need to take into account. And I think that on both parts, there have been some deficiencies in how some of these contracts have been negotiated. But, you know, you've already touched on it briefly, is to say that you have brought in all this capacity, you've put in, you had all these banks putting in all this money, over $5 billion to invest into energy generation. What's happening with your distribution network? You know, what could have been done to actually build up that infrastructure so that the electricity can actually reach households? Because at the moment, you know, your per capita consumption in Kenya is very low. It's about 60 kilowatt hours, and that's very low. It's going to be very hard to actually say that, okay, I want to build an economy. What do you need to build an economy? You need energy. It's going to be very hard to then say, please come and invest. And then when they look at things like that, it's like, okay, so who's actually going to be using this electricity? So multifaceted, but very interesting that now the Ugandan government has really come out strongly over the past couple of months. And I think effectively saying that we are definitely scrapping them.
Yeah, and I guess it's one that we might want to learn some lessons from, especially this, you know, I guess, divergence between demand and I guess the ability to take some of the energy that's been generated or the supply of energy onto the grid, and the need for investment in transmission. Kanya, we'll have to leave it here for tonight. I would have wanted us to talk about the Kenyan story out there of Facebook, but certainly one we can pick up a bit later. But thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Aya. Cheers.